Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, political memoirs these days are kind of a dime a dozen. We've already seen several come out of the Bush administration just the past couple of years. The president himself had one that a lot of people found pretty interesting about his major decisions. Donald Rumsfeld pretty much had his whole life story in there, but obviously a lot of it was on his time during his second tour as defense secretary. But I think the one that most conservatives are licking their chops for is the one from Dick Cheney. And it's just a matter of a little while now before this will come out. We've seen the cover. It's called In My Time. I can think of a few things he said during his time as vice president that also could have been used, and I'm kind of glad he didn't. his daughter, Liz Cheney Perry, says, expect some very candid thoughts in here, and I can't wait.
The Washington memoir is a particular art form. I think it was Christopher Buckley who said the subtitle of each one should always be, "If only they had listened to me." And to a certain extent, like, obviously, besides the life story of a major figure, I got to say, among the Washington memoirs I've enjoyed the most in recent years were that of Bob Novak and Donald Rumsfeld, and mostly because there was just so much score settling. Don't tell me how wonderful it was to work with everyone around you and how everyone was one big happy family and how swell everything was, because one, I'm skeptical that really was the case, and two, it doesn't particularly make for a particularly interesting memoir. No drama there, no conflict or excitement. And both those, the Novak and Rumsfeld ones were just dripping with, I don't want to say fury, but perhaps righteous indignation and frustration and a chance to really come out and say and pull no punches. And, that's probably a really good way to describe what we're expecting of the Cheney memoir. Greg, I think just the best way of describing it is I feel a feeling you're going to open up this book and it's just going to feel like a shotgun blast to the face. It's just a and also kind of interesting, like the title In My Time is interesting. It almost suggests that this was the era of Cheney. It was the Bush presidency, but maybe in a way the most memorable or distinctive figure from the entire Bush administration may end up being Vice President Cheney.
Yeah, Cheney had such a difficult time throughout his political career of just really saying what he thought about people and different ideas. So it's good to see him coming out of his shell a little bit and actually being really direct about his opinions on various policy and various politicians.
I can sense your sarcasm, but like when he actually was named as Bush's running mate, that actually was the perception, that he had been a very standard issue Secretary of Defense. He actually hadn't been terribly controversial. And there was a lot of people who said, well, look, he's competent, but is this a guy who really can handle politics? And one of the all-time horrific miscalculations, thinking that Dick Cheney was not ready for the tough knife fights of partisan politics.
Yeah, exactly right. So when you think of some of the vanilla memoirs that have come out of the most recent administration, as well as certainly out of the Clinton and even Reagan's memoirs were kind of surfacey. And so this one, I think, is going to be very, very good. On to number two now, and the situation involving the International Monetary Fund has been interesting, to say the least, in recent years, and certainly over the past week, as Dominique Strauss-Kahn, as just about all of you know, is sitting in Rikers Island jail, seemingly at the center of a Law & Order SVU episode. He has obviously pled not guilty to attempted rape on a hotel maid. Now he's going to try and come up with some other excuse to get out of prison and be basically under house arrest until his trial in New York City. The other story here, and I certainly don't want to minimize the very graphic and horrific charges against him, why was a socialist, a self-avowed socialist, head of the International Monetary Fund, and why is it that the woman who many people think is going to replace him seems to be a bosom buddy of his? This doesn't exactly bode well for an organization that you and I probably don't have much use for anyway, but certainly don't have much confidence in going forward if this is the people they seem to keep picking to run the show.
Obviously, I think most conservatives, whenever they hear about a large international organization with a lot of money, just the hairs at the back of their neck stand up. There's very little good things come from that. We shouldn't be surprised that this is, I believe Mark Stein had observed that, think about the absurdity that reading about one of the earlier presidential elections in France, that Jacques Chirac was considered the candidate of the right. Now, obviously, Jacques Chirac, that pretty vehemently anti-American, and, obviously life in France with when they had the 35-hour work week, not exactly a paragon of free market democracy. So the idea that Chirac is on the right, who's the guy to the left? And obviously that, he says you measure the distinctions in French politics by microns. I mean, there's just, Now, this is my understanding. I'm not wouldn't claim to be an expert on French politics, but is that they all largely go to the same schools. They all largely go to the same early jobs in their careers, and who basically there very much is a governing class. Now, obviously, this is the land of the French Revolution and the revolt against the aristocracy, and it's good to see they've completely changed things, Greg. It's nothing like that at all. But maybe that's, you know, one of the things is that you can talk socialism, you can talk about the importance of the common man, and then spend your nights in a $3,000 a night hotel room and have, you know, apparently this unbelievable expense account and fly on Air France whenever you want. And, you know, I'm struck by the apparently the new excuse is going to be that this was a consensual sexual encounter that she changed her mind on. I'm sure this guy who looks a cross between, you know, Gerard Depardieu and Sidney Greenstreet, I'm sure she just couldn't keep her arms off him because he was such a strikingly, you know, masculine tower of raw, you know, sexual charisma. So, yeah, it's very plausible that she just decided to stop what she was doing and begin to, you know, have a relationship with him right then and there. Yeah, okay. There's a perception this will hurt the socialists in the upcoming French elections. As somebody who likes that, you know, several millimeters to the right candidate more than the several millimeters to the left candidate in foreign politics, I guess that's pretty good news for us. I think the what we're seeing in general out of French society, though, is not really that reassuring. That apparently it's very widespreadly believing over there that this is all a grand conspiracy, that somehow Sarkozy is behind this. And a lot of people are not really convinced that this guy did anything all that wrong.
Yeah, Sarkozy somehow extracted this guy's DNA and somehow got it to this indigent HIV-positive hotel maid in New York City. Apparently, he's going with the OJ defense team about DNA being in strange places when it couldn't possibly have otherwise been there. Mark Furman, I think, will be on the stand before this is over.
Oh.
On to number three now.
Say, do we have any crazy martinis, Greg?
On to number three now, and there's this leftist interest group called the Agenda Project. I have to admit, I've never heard of them before, but they're trying to be a player in the game now, and they've come out with a new ad against the Paul Ryan plan to make the nation more fiscally solvent and to reform Medicare in a way that keeps it afloat more than a few years from now. So they've come out with this ad where you can't really see the young man in the suit, but at least his face, but he's pushing this old lady in a wheelchair, which seems like through a very nice, picturesque park on a beautiful day. And as it goes along, America the Beautiful is playing, and you see that the Medicare system was created in 1965. 46 million older Americans rely on it. Many of them live on $28,000 per year or less. And then the young man takes Grandma all the way to the cliff overlooking the sea and dumps her into the ocean with America the Beautiful still playing. And then the words, is America still beautiful without Medicare? And obviously, this is over the top, literally. And the question that comes at the end makes me wonder, do these people think America wasn't beautiful before 1965, that that they're proud of America for the first time in their lives, like Michelle Obama said during the campaign? What is exactly the point here, other than they're trying to clearly demonize Paul Ryan?
You know, two thoughts when you told me about this, Greg. The first is, it sounded really familiar to me. And I started thinking, all right, why, where have I seen this before, heard this before? In 2002, there was a Democrat ad that was a cartoon of George W. Bush pushing an elderly lady off a cliff, and, you know, who was in a wheelchair off a cliff. And I actually found it online. I may post it on a campaign spot later. But in other words, this is not just a demagogic attack. It's not just an unfair attack. It's not just a raw, you know, very partisan act by a group that claims to not have a partisan agenda, et cetera. It is also cliche. And it's a tired cliche. And usually, you know, when you and I are talking about Democratic attack ads, we usually say, oh, they say we're going to push granny out in the snow, et cetera. And now here are ads depicting the hyperbolic, like we cannot parody Democratic attack ads anymore. They now do this. And the other thing, when you talk about whether Democrats believe it required Medicare to make America beautiful, I believe Obama said pretty explicitly that we were not a great nation until we created this social safety net. Which, you know, look, I am, you know, no country is ever going to be perfect. But if you had to, you know, I look back to the America of 1776. I look back to the United States of the Civil, you know, all throughout our history. I think we've either, you know, been a great nation or had the potential to be a great nation. And I got to tell you, like, really, Social Security was what did it? Medicaid, Medicare, that's what we actually switched over to the great category. Not, you know, not beating the Nazis, not fighting a civil war over slavery, not putting a man, you know, like. Not the great age of exploration or anything. Really, none of this? Really? You know, maybe it's perspective. I guess if you consider government programs the definition of America, then obviously, you know, cutting a government program to you would be effectively cutting America. And that is, you know, government and the nation are interchangeable in the minds of, I think, some folks on the left. And this ad pretty clearly, you know, pretty explicitly makes that clear.
I think that is exactly the stake that they're putting down. And I think that really sets up what I hope will be a very clear debate for the 2012 election. The president's obviously good at distracting and obfuscating, but he clearly believes it based on his agenda. And it's obvious that his allies in this march do as well, because the president demonized Paul Ryan just as much as the folks in this ad, if not more, in that speech on the budget a few weeks ago. So, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.